Sutta number 75. There's a Chinese translation of that in the Madhyama Agama of the
Sarvasivadin school.
Translated in, it's about 400 and something, I think about 440. Gautama Sanghadeva was the translator. No other parallels for this sutta have turned up so far. And not very much information on the Magandhya's background. He was supposed to be relation to another Magandhya who appears in a different sutta, but that's according to the commentary. Now Magandhya was a paribhajika, a wanderer, and so before we start the sutta, I thought we might just read a little bit of a description of a wanderer, what a wanderer is. And we've already discussed this a little bit in the history classes and so on we've done before. Here's a discussion, an old discussion. This is by B.C. Law, who was a one of the classic old Indologists, and this one happens to be available online. So it's just talking about different kinds of wanderers. According to Rhys Davids, were teachers or sophists who spent 8 or 9 months of every year wandering about precisely with the object of engaging in conversational discussions on matters of ethics and philosophy, nature, law, and mysticism. Like the sophists among the Greeks, they differed very much in intelligence, in earnestness, and in honesty. And you might also say, like the rishis and sages you find today in India, and perhaps you might even say the same thing about Buddhist monks, but anyway. In the Anguttara Nikaya, we find mention of two classes of paribhajikas. The first is the Anyatitya paribhajika, and the second class is the Brahmana paribhajika. Okay, so what the Anyatitya is the non-Brahmanical lineage, and then the Brahmins are from the Brahmanical or the Vedic lineage. So you find paribhajikas from both groups. So for example, the Kassapa brothers, who the Buddha converted with the fire sermon, they are probably should be classed among the Brahmana paribhajikas, the fire worshipping ascetics. Although maybe they weren't wanderers because they lived in a hermitage, but anyway. So the main idea is that there are certain of these wanderers and ascetics, some of them following the Vedic scriptures and Vedic tradition and some of them not. Brahmana paribhajikas were in the habit of discussing sandhitika dhamma, that is matters pertaining to this phenomenal world, i.e. to here and now, the term corresponding in some way or other way to lokayatra, the ways of life or mundane affairs. It's not quite correct. Lokayata actually means cosmology. Anyatitya paribhajikas were interested generally in this question of self-realization in thought and in conduct, that is to say, in solemn judgments about human life and the whole of things. Okay, in the paribhajika, explained in the Vashishta Dharma Shastra, so one of the Hindu law books, should shave his head, clothe himself with one piece of cloth or antelope skin. As you see always, people like Shiva and so on are associated with that, and cover their body with grass plucked by, or cover his body with grass plucked by cows. He should sleep on bare ground. Possibly the paribhajikas have been around since the end period of the Rig Veda, but it's certainly not clear how long that they were around for. Is this written before the Indus Valley was discovered, maybe?
No.
When was the Indus Valley?
Well, that was in the
1918.
This is about
1918.
That'd be after the Indus Valley.
Was it?
I thought the Indus Valley was actually discovered in the 19th. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I think it was a bit later than that, actually. Yeah, I think it was a bit later.
So I was reading something about it recently.
Yeah. Okay. Blah blah blah. The philosophy in India was up to a certain date was a lay movement, according to Rhys Davids. Yajnavalkya, who we talked about just the other day, was probably the connecting link between the past and the subsequent ages. Sophistic activity progressed rapidly through the reign of Janaka, the king of Videha, one of the best-known patrons of Indian philosophy. The kingdom of Janaka resounded with philosophical contests held between Yajnavalkya and other renowned teachers of his time, among whom were some women, notably Gargi. But that was in a period of Indian history when the ideal of renunciation had not taken permanent hold of something of the mind of the people. The Yajnavalkya and his opponents were almost without single exception householders. Except Yajnavalkya himself went forth. I'm not sure why he's missed that bit out. But in the expressions of Yajnavalkya, we can first trace for the first time any reference to two orders of teachers, hermits and recluses, tapasas and shramanas. Okay. So.
Isn't that the same thing?
What?
Hermits and recluses.
Something like that, yeah. Hermits.
Synonymous terms?
Yeah, more or less. Mm. Yeah, and in Sanskrit they're also more or less synonymous, but they may have been used to refer to different orders. Yeah, it's hard to say. Okay, I won't go into that. Okay, so it's some kind of wanderer who has gone forth and practicing the ascetic life. So we're lucky that. And on this occasion, we have the text available from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation on the web, so that's lucky, from the Google Books. Thank you, Google. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama, on a spread of grass in the fire chamber of a Brahmin belonging to the Bharadvaja clan. Okay, so the Kuru country. The Kuru country was famous for, it was the battle in the Bhagavad Gita, the climax of the Mahabharata, the greatest Indian epic, was held on the Kuru, the battlefield of the Kurukshetra, the field of the Kurus.
And who was fighting?
The Pandavas and the other one, what's the other one called? The two groups of cousins. And they were... they've massed their armies finally and they're facing each other across the battlefield, and at the dawn of battle Arjuna goes with his charioteer to the middle between them and sees his relatives on both sides, and then he wavers, doubts whether he should go to war. Turns out his charioteer was Krishna, and Krishna gives this extraordinary, and that's basically what the Bhagavad Gita is the teachings of Krishna at that point. It's a fantastic literary conceit. So yeah, as Ayananda mentioned, this is a stock introduction. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kamasadama for alms. When he'd wandered for alms in Kamasadama, he'd returned from his alms round. After his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Then the wanderer Magandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, walking and wandering for exercise. I'm not sure whether that's quite a good translation there. There's nothing in the sutta that says that he's actually walking and wandering for exercise. It just says, anuchankamano, anuvicharamano. So it just says, it basically seems to mean just doing walking meditation. There's nothing about doing it for exercise as such, but anyway. Went to the fire chamber of the Brahmin wandering for the Bharadvaja clan. Then he saw a spread of grass prepared and asked the Brahmin, for whom has this spread of grass been prepared in Master Bharadvaja's fire chamber? It seems like it might be a recluse's bed. So it's kind of interesting from a religious point of view that there doesn't seem to be anything unusual or whatever about the fact that the Buddha is having, you know, a rest in and staying in this obviously religious place of a Brahmin. Yeah? It's just his fire chamber. It's where he would be doing his offerings and things like that. And so he's just staying there, and it seems to be perfectly okay. Master Magandhya, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans who went forth from a Sakyan clan. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. This bed has been prepared for that Master Gotama. Okay. So, of course, this passage being the Itipiso passage, which we recite each week. Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samasambuddho. And Magandhya's response, indeed, Master Bharadvaja, it is an ill sight We see, when we see the bed of that destroyer of growth, Master Gotama. Okay, so this is the word that he's using here, the destroyer of growth. Buhunahuno. It's a bit, it's a very obscure word, not entirely clear what it means, but the explanation destroyer of growth is justified both by the Pali, by the Chinese and also the Pali commentaries. But it's interesting because the root here, bhu, maybe expand that a bit. The root here, bhu, of course you remember from your Pali classes, those who are here at Pali classes, to be, yeah? And hu is from the root to kill or destroy. So the destroyer of being, so you could just translate it as a destroyer, an exterminator, a terminator. You could translate it, Gotama the Terminator. Destroyer of being, yeah. But the interesting little thing about it is that if you translate bhu as growth here, like coming to more being, then that harks back to actually what is supposed to be a very old meaning, or the very basic meaning of the word bhu is to grow. Okay, so it actually comes from watching plants grow and so on, and seeing that they become more. And so this is, the word bhu still has that implication on occasion. So this is why the idea of destroyer of growth. And Bharadvaja, of course, Bharadvaja, come back to the fact that they're in the Kuru country, okay, which is the story told in the Mahabharata. And we notice here we have Bharadvaja. Bhara is the same word as Bharata, literally meaning bear, to bear something. And dwa is two, ja is born. Okay, so dwaja is twice born. So this is a word for the Brahmins, because they were born both from their mother and also from Brahma. And Bhara, so hailing from the same clan as the word Mahabharata comes from. And a very interesting article by, I think it's Vijayasekara, and he argued that the word Bhara originally meant booty. So it means what the Aryan invaders would invade, take off with the loot. So basically the Bhara is the loot which they ripped off from the settled inhabitants. And so this is the one who was the Bhara, was the bearer, was obviously the one who got most of the loot. And so it became the leading clan. But that was a long, long time ago. Okay. Many learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses have full confidence in Master Gotama and have been disciplined by him in the noble, true way, in the Dhamma that is wholesome. Okay. And then the true way is the Vinita. They have faith, Vinita, they've been led. This is a word derived from the same root as Vinaya. Arya Nyaya, they've been led by him in the Arya, in the noble Nyaya, is a word meaning like a method, right, or a path or something like that, or in the Dhamma which is wholesome, Dhamme Kusale. So it comes back to what we were discussing the other night about what should we call ourselves. Yeah? Should we call ourselves Buddhists or Theravadins, or what exactly are we? I don't really know, but this is one of the words that they used in the Buddha's time to describe what they were teaching. Arya Nyaya, the noble method, or the Dhamme Kusale, the skillful Dhamma. So there's a couple of words for Buddhism. To which Magandhya replies, Master Bharadvaja, even if we saw that Master Gotama face to face, we would tell him to his face, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that has come down in our discourse. Now this is kind of an interesting thing here. It says, evan hino sutte ocharati. So it says, come down in our sutta, literally. But interesting that it also that just mentions the sutta. I mean, it's not the only texts which are actually mentioned explicitly in the suttas are the Brahmanical ones. Now, the fact that he's a wanderer, the fact that he's having this conversation with this Brahman suggests that he is actually a Brahmanical wanderer, not one of the Anyatitiya Paripajikas. So the sutta that he's referring to here probably is the Vedic scriptures in some way. Exactly what it is not sure. And then Bharadvaja answers, if Master Magandhi has no objection, may I tell this to Master Gotama? And then Magandhi says, let Master Bharadvaja be at ease, tell him just what I have said. This section that we just read there has a slightly different sequence of events. The Pali one we've just read, in the Chinese version, the Brahman first asks Magandhya if his abusive expression may be reported to the Buddha, in reply to which Magandhya proclaimed to have no qualms to repeat the same himself in front of the Buddha. Okay, so in the Pali version, Magandhi says, I'm going to tell the Buddha this, and then Bharadvaja says, well, do you mind if I say it? And in the Chinese version, first of all, the Brahman says, do you mind if I tell the Buddha? And then Magandhi says, well, I'll tell him myself. Okay, so Analia says reasonably enough that the Chinese version seems to be a bit more logical here. Okay, seems to be a more natural flow of the conversation. Yeah, they talk about something, Bharadvaja says, well, look, do you mind if I tell the Buddha about what you said? And he says, don't worry about it, I'll tell him myself. So, meanwhile, with the divine ear, which is purified and surpasses the human. So this is, of course, a stock phrase on the divine ear. Dibbaya sotu dhatu visuddhaya atikanta manusikaya. Always appears in the list of the various kinds of psychic powers. So the Buddha's eavesdropping there. Heard the conversation between the Brahman and the wanderer. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One arose from meditation, went to the Brahman's fire chamber and sat down, and the spread of grass made ready. Then the Brahman of the Bharadvaja clan went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. So it's good to see the Buddha's not in any kind of hurry to get to do this. He's sitting out there, sitting meditation under a tree, and he's not particularly hassled about things. He's just, at this point, he's staying by himself. He's not staying in a monastery, just wandering around the place. Goes for alms, goes for a nice little sit for the daytime in the park, and he knows he's got this issue to deal with, but he doesn't run off to deal with it, just waits till the right time. Then he went to Bharadvaja. Did you have any conversation with the wanderer Magandhya about this very same spread of grass? When this was said, the Brahman, awestruck and with his hair standing on end, replied, oh, we wanted to tell Master Gotama about that very thing, but Master Gotama has anticipated us. So in the Chinese version, it has another extra description of the beautiful sight of the Buddha, who is just like the moon surrounded by stars, emanating a bright light like a golden mountain. Okay, so this kind of description is found, this is a stock description in the Madhyama Agama. Analia gives a list of passages here where it appears in the Madhyama Agama, and doesn't appear at all in the Madhyama Nikaya. So this is one reason why Venerable Thikmin Chao, who did the first comparative study of these two, felt that the Madhyama Agama on balance tends to be slightly later and tends to have a greater tendency to sort of turn the Buddha into a god, to deify the Buddha. Obviously you find that tendency within every Buddhist tradition, but it seems to be more manifest in the Madhyama Agama compared with the Madhyama Nikaya. Although they're very difficult to make generalizations about this, you can't simply say that the Madhyama Agama is later. It's just a very general tendency, and each individual passage has to be understood in its own context. Many times where the Madhyama Agama may be earlier than the Madhyama Nikaya as well. Okay, back to Sutta. Then this conversation was left unfinished, for then the wanderer Magandhya came to the Brahman's fire chamber and went up to the Blessed One, exchanged greetings, sat down to him. The Blessed One said to him, Magandhya, the eye delights in forms, takes delight in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata. guarded, protected, and restrained, and he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was with reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures, in our suttas. The ear delights in sounds, the nose delights in odours, the tongue delights in flavours, the body delights in tangibles, the mind delights in mind objects, takes delight in mind objects and rejoices in mind objects. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected and restrained, and he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it in reference to this that you said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was with reference to that I said recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. So, the Buddha not only knows what Magandhi was talking, but he also knows why he was saying it. Of course, the reason why that is a little bit obscure, why has this idea of being a destroyer of growth related to enjoyment of sense objects? Yeah, and so do kittens.
Mm-hmm.
So do kittens.
Yeah. But he's talking about sense objects.
That's right, but why does he talk about sense objects rather than kittens? That's right, but why give an exposition in terms of the six sense bases? Why not in terms of the four elements or the five khandhas or anything else?
Maybe because Gandhiya had learned the teaching that was already along those lines, structured along those lines.
Could be. And why is that specially related to the idea of Bu Nahuno? Being a destroyer of growth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's good. That's how life is full, yeah? You think that your life becomes full by that? So life without it is impoverished, perhaps? Perhaps something like that? I wonder... Yeah, well,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Which is what?
Well, Ken, probably because of his Tibetan English background.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what often goes missing in the ascetic forms of Buddhism,
yeah,
that's indicated by Theravada, is So his belief is that the best kind of spirituality is the one that you can best both the freedom and the fullness.
Here's a here's the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and again referring back to the Brahmanical scriptures, trying to make some actual connections here between what's going on and what may have been in the culture at the time. And I was talking yesterday, we were talking about Satipatthana, and I mentioned the dialogue with Yajnavalkya and the Ekayana dialogue. And then that's just finished, okay? That's the end of that particular dialogue, that section that I was just talking about yesterday. How, O beloved, should he know himself, the knower? Okay, Arjuna talking to his wife, Maitreyi. Okay, so where there is a duality, this is the last verse of Yajnavalkya. For when there was, as it were, duality, then one sees the other, smells the other, one hears the other, one salutes the other, one perceives the other, one knows the other. But when the self only is all this, how should he smell another? How should he see another? How should he hear another? How should he salute another? How should he perceive another? How should he know another? How should he know him by whom he knows all this? How should he know the knower? And so this is Yajnavalkya's doctrine. And the very next verse, as it happens, has this thing which I think is maybe relevant. And this is giving an idea of Brahmanical philosophy, the higher levels of Brahmanical philosophy in the time immediately before the Buddha. This earth is the honey of all beings, and all beings are the honey of this earth. Likewise, this bright immortal person in this earth and that bright immortal person incorporated in the body, both are honey for each other. He indeed is the same as that self, that immortal, that Brahman, that all. This water is the honey of all beings, and all beings are the honey of this water. This fire is the honey of all beings. This air is the honey. This sun is the honey. The space, the moon, the lightning, the thunder, the ether, again, space. Ether, this law, this Dhamma is the honey of all beings. This truth, Satya. This mankind is the honey of all beings. This self is the honey of all beings. And all beings are the honey of this self. Likewise, this bright immortal person in this self and that bright immortal person, the self, both are honey for each other. He indeed is the same as that self, that immortal, that Brahman, that all. And verily, this self is the lord of all beings, the king of all beings, and as all spokes are contained in the axle and the felly of a wheel, all beings and all those selves of the water, earth and water are contained in that self. I was supposed to have been taught through the head of a horse. He had a horse's head on his head. Anyway, we'll leave the horse's heads aside. But anyway.
I think the word Madhubhicha,
yeah.
The word Bhicha not only a malik or a prim, but it means a spell.
A spell, yeah?
Yes, and your Madhu here, it means your spell or something with exchange, something exchange, the mutation.
Like an element, yeah.
Yeah, so it is a translation, it might be a term, also we can't a term, so it's not. Just the word which cannot be a spell.
A spell, yeah.
It's just something like a casual being.
Yeah, yeah.
What's
a spell? The word vidya. The word vidya is actually means a spell. All the way through here, the honey vidya. This whole thing is called the Madhu Vidya. Literally, it's like the honey spell.
So honey is Madhu Vidya.
Madhu is honey. So vidya equals knowledge, knowledge or spell. Of course, the spell actually was the knowledge, but interestingly enough, vidya is exactly parallel to the English word wicca. If you look at the spelling, equals witchcraft. Yeah. So this is why wicca is spelt the way it is, because it's descended exactly from the Pali. So this is what that is. So this is, but one of the essences of magic and witchcraft is the idea that things share common essence to each other. So this is why you can do one thing to this and it will affect that thing over there, because they actually are, they use the term mystic participation for magic. Things all participate in each other. So here, and the idea that they participate, but also the idea that you can phrase that participation through using the idea of honey. Right, so everything is pervaded with that thing which is the most sweet. Yeah. So it gives, and the honey is very nutritious. So it's like the whole world is pervaded with this sweet, nutritious essence of life. Yeah. So it's a very positive doctrine, saying that this earth is full of honey, and the space is, everything is full of this honey. Yeah. So it's a very positive doctrine, and so I think it's perhaps when compared with this kind of teaching, that then when someone hears the Buddha's kind of teaching, that's where they come to this idea that he's a destroyer of growth, because he's kind of sucking the life out of the world. Yeah, it's I think it's halfway between an enchantment, a spell, and also a philosophical teaching. You know, I think it has both.
Yeah.
So the term, it would be interesting to look at how it's been used in the Brahmanical tradition, whether it's been used as a spell and so on. It's quite famous. Like when I googled it, it came up with all kinds of responses. So it must be well known in the Brahmanical tradition, but I'm not really sure how it's used. You know.
It also has back to the description of the origins of the world.
Rasapatavi, yeah. Yeah, similar kind of idea, yeah. Like the same as milk and honey in the Bible. It's different spelling. Yeah, the Vija, as I spelt it here, this is a Pali spelling, actually. And the Sanskrit spelling is vidya. Yeah, I'm sure it has a long A, but probably. Vidya. Vidya, vidya. Yeah, vidya. Yeah, it's very similar, slightly different. Vidya, vidya. In the what? Sorry? That's right, madhyama. Yeah. Alright. Yeah, vidya is a negative form of the same thing, yeah. Okie dokie, so it's maybe just giving some background as to why Magandhi is thinking the way that he does. So, the Buddha says...
So he thinks that Buddhism is a bit of a...
what?
A kilter, sort of.
Exactly, wowzers. As Ajahn Brahm says, and as... skip sutta somehow. That's right, yeah, not all wanderers were ascetics. Sorry, which one? Okay, Subha Sutta. Subha Sutta, oh yeah, yeah.
There's a conversation with Subha and Buddha about what the highest form of life in the Brahmanical tradition is, and Subha said that it's the
way life. Yeah. So this would be a similar thing. There was a tension within the, as it said, with that reference to Parabhajika as I read at the beginning, the lay idea, you know, the renunciate idea was originally not part of the Brahmanical tradition at all, and gradually came to be accepted as part of it, but it was never as fundamental to it as it was in Buddhism. And even today, it really, you know, in modern Hinduism, it really depends on what kind of Hinduism you practice. There are some kinds that have monastic orders and so on, and others that don't. Yeah, it really depends. Okay. So, and also just to note that Magandhi's epistemology, he's relying purely on scriptural reference. He's not relying on his own reasoning or experience at all. What do you think, Magandhi? Here somebody may have formerly enjoyed himself with forms cognizable via that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger and the escape in the case of forms, he may abandon that craving for forms, remove the fever for forms and abide without thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Magandhiya? Nothing, Master Gautama. Right, so the Buddha is not at all defensive here, to put it mildly. And I'll just go through that particular passage. Okay, so this particular passage is one of the stock phrases, stock passages in the Buddhist, in the Pali Canon. So I'll just go through that, just give you some familiarity with the vocabulary here. Okay, here a certain person, Chaku Vinyehi. So Chaku is the eye. Vinyeya is to be, is cognizable or to be cognized. So this is the vinya part is from the same root as vinyana. And the aya here means to be cognizable or able to be cognized. Okay, it's just a grammatical form meaning that. And then the ehi is the instrumental plural ending. Okay, so cognizable by the eye is how you usually translate it, or able to be cognized by the eye. And these are forms. Okay. One has paricharita pubbo, has formally practiced that or formally lived in that way. They're all nouns actually. They're noun forms. As a compound. They do, yeah. The actual noun here is rupa in the plural. So the forms which are cognizable by the eye it acts in the way as an adjective. Describing itehi, which is wished for. It's from the past participle of icha. Kantehi, manapehi, pirupehi, of delightful form. Okay. Kamupasanhitehi, related to sensual desire, and radniyehi, provoking lust. Okay, so this is a standard list of terms, obviously just a series of synonyms of terms for desire here. I'm just thinking I actually made a mistake in the grammar just a minute ago. The ehi here is refers to the whole sentence, not to just that individual phrase. Ehi is an instrumental plural, the whole phrase, yeah, not just that one. So it's here a certain person has formerly lived or practiced or whatever with forms that are cognizable by the eye, that are delightful, pleasing, wished for, beautiful, etc., etc., etc. Then at a later occasion, those same rupas, rupanam yeva, so rupanam is forms, yeva, those very same forms, samudayancha, the origination, atangamancha, the ending, asadancha, the gratification, adinavancha, the danger, and the nisarananca, the escape. So these five things: origination, ending, gratification, danger, escape. This is very, very commonly found in suttas. Yatha bhutang viditva, having understood them as they really are, or more accurately, as they have been conditioned to be, then has abandoned craving for form, has abandoned fever for form, has dispelled pati vinodetva, fever for form, and is without thirst for form, is internally dwells with mind at peace, vupasanta citta. What would you have to say to him? Na kinchi, whatever, not whatever. So stop the passage here. So again, notice the different tendencies, as well as comparing the Brahmanical scripture to the Buddhist one. Not one tendency that we saw was the Brahmanical tendency to imbue fullness or life in everything in a very positive way, but also the tendency, of course, everything was interpreted in terms of a self. So there's an identity with everything, and so it's constantly has this metaphysical dimension of this idea of a self. Whereas when we look at the Buddhist analysis of these things, there's no metaphysics involved in this. There's purely what's your experience. You know, there's nothing in there that falls outside of ordinary experience that everybody has. Yeah? You see things, you like them, desire arises for them, and then that heats up the mind, and when you abandon that desire for them, then the mind becomes cool. So this is just purely a straightforward psychological analysis. And of course repeated for all the different sense bases. Sota vinye yehi sadehi ghana vinye yehi gandhehi jivha vinye yehi rasehi gaya vinye yehi potabehi. And Buddha, in the Pali version, the Buddha goes on to say, Magandhya, formerly when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter, one for the summer. I lived in the rain's palace for the 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians, none of whom were men. And I did not go down to the lower palace.
This is just the word that actually likes his gay.
A glorious understatement. Yeah. Well, I'm sure they are very good musicians anyway. Well, what do you mean by musicians? All I can say is, well, the Pali term is going down here. No, I don't think so. 4 months of the rain. See, this is how they spend the rainy season. You know, that's what I call fullness. Yeah. Okay. Nip puri sehi, without men, duriehi, the musicians. So that's his rain retreat. So where are we now? In the Chinese version, blah blah blah. The Chinese version does not mention this palace life at all. According to the Chinese version, all of the Buddha educated was that in his lay time he had had easy access to the five types of sensual pleasures. Hence here again the tendency to enhance the qualities and status of the Buddha appears to be at work, this time leaving its imprint on the Pali discourse. I don't think that's an entirely fair statement by Analia there. I mean, previously we had the statement in the Chinese version, which was the Buddha was like a moon surrounded by stars and radiating with light like a golden mountain. Whereas here he's simply referring to his time before he ordained. And what Analia is trying to do is he's trying to balance it out and to show that you can't sort of generalize and say only one is early and one is late. It may well be that that extra detail included in the Pali version is a later detail there. It may also not be.
I don't think it's
a consistent
version.
It
what, sorry? I think it's actually the right version.
Because?
If you minimize the extravagance of sensual pleasure in the previous slide, like you're describing, you know, being in.
Yeah.
So that's not very, you know, noble, or not very defined.
By downplaying his.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a contrast with this divine thing.
Exactly.
With the moon and all that.
Could be, except that's such a standard part of the Buddha biography that all the later biographies just exaggerated that beyond measure. I mean, they went on, you read like Buddha, Ashvaghosa goes on for page after page describing all the delights of all the musicians and stuff like that.
Yeah, especially saying the number of women.
Yeah.
For me, it just seems to be going in the same direction, trying to make
I'm not sure, but the other thing is that the greater his enjoyment, then also the greater his renunciation.
Mm-hmm. One thing I just wonder, in Pali Gita Rasa, they make a very detailed description on your sensual pleasure enjoyment in your human work of the Buddha's former life as well in your celestial realm. They describe one male, there were 500 female. They were celestial nymphs.
Yeah, this is one of the hell realms, yeah.
So, why is it compiler when enjoying
your
things, so make a
very easy description? That's right, yeah. I think we can safely say that that text wasn't compiled by the bhikkhunis. They do go on a bit, don't they? So, okay. So anyway, there's a slight difference. I'm a bit reluctant personally to read anything particularly into that detail. It could just as easily been dropped out as it may have been put in. So I'm not particularly. But the idea of the Buddha's luxury life is of course found commonly in all the traditions. It's just whether it actually appears in this particular passage or not. Okay. So, later occasion, having understood this, actually are the origin, disappearance, gratification, the danger, and the escape. In the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving, fever, and so on. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever, indulging in them, and I do not envy them. Nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, my Gandhiya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome dhammas, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Okay? So, when the Buddha says there is a delight which is better, then the Pali anyatra kamehi, anyatra akusalehi damehi. Okay, so anyone would of course recognize this from the beginning of the formula for the first jhana, viviceva kamehi, vivice akusalehi damehi. And so here the Buddha is referring to his practice of jhanas, which is better than divine pleasure. So why should he delight in sensual pleasures? And so this is the always the Buddha's response to the practice of indulgence in sensual pleasures is that actually you're happier off with restraint. And so of course that then comes back to answering that question of Ken Wilber's about the fullness. And the practice of jhana is of course gives a fullness which is an experience of pleasure. Yeah? Which is, so it's not a matter of denying the experience of pleasure, but it's a matter of experiencing that kind of skillful pleasure rather than unskillful ones. So So it's important to notice that, that as soon as in Buddhism we slip over into denying pleasure, we start to lose the plot. We start to, because the mind actually works on pleasure. This is the problem. You can say, well, certain pleasures are bad, but the mind works on pleasure. I mean, it's like in today when we have to worry about, overconsumption causing global warming. You can't just tell people do without, because that's what makes them happy. Buying stuff makes them happy. They have to actually have a source of pleasure, which is not based on that. So you have to survive that. Sorry?
There's another thing you're saying about that.
Uh-huh. And what's that?
Well, he talks about how if you're going to get people into meditation, there needs to be an O spot.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be able to take meditation in a way that gives them quite a shocking, pleasurable experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, what am I missing out on?
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't talk at all about jhanas. Oh, he does talk about samadhi, but he doesn't talk about jhanas.
Yeah.
In terms of the Buddhist faith, he talks.
Exactly, yeah. So this is one of the problems with Ken Wilber. It's unfortunate he doesn't have a grounding in the suttas. So yeah, he learned his Buddhism primarily from the Zen people and then secondarily from the Tibetans. Neither of them talk about jhanas and stuff. I mean, the Tibetans do in their... I'm not sure how much in their practical meditations they do. They still have an understanding of it from their Abhidhamma studies. But how much... Because it's all in the... The primary Abhidhamma text is the Abhidhamma Kosha, which talks about jhanas at some length. So it's certainly there, and I've had some discussion with a Tibetan monk about that. And we were talking, I had a conversation, and I said, all the kind of different kinds of jhanas that people have. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, some people say that you can be in jhana and still be thinking about things and experiencing things through the senses. And he said, what? He said, that's not real. That's hardly worthy of being called concentration, is it? Say, well, yeah, some people think it is, but so they obviously had an understanding of it, but it's probably not at the forefront. But that's maybe changing also recently. Suppose, Magandhi, a householder's son was rich with great wealth and property, and being provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, he might enjoy himself with forms, sounds, and so on. Having conducted himself well in body, speech, and mind on the dissolution of the body after death, he might reappear in a happy destination in the heavenly world of the retinue of the gods of the 33, and there, surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana Grove, he would enjoy himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure. Now, suppose he then saw a householder's son enjoying himself. What do you think? Would that young god, surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana Grove, enjoying himself, would he envy the householder for the five cords of human sensual pleasure? Or would he be enticed by human sensual pleasures? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because divine sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. So too, Magandhya. Formerly, when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself with sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. Having a later occasion, having understood as they really are, and having abandoned them, I abide without thirst. I see other beings burning with thirst for sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, because I know a superior pleasure apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome dhammas. Suppose, now we get to the graphic bits. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Probably not such an uncommon sight. Then his friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. So this calls into question the translation here. Kutti is a leper, and it's in the ordination chanting, Kuttang Gando. Kuttang is a leprosy. But leprosy has no cure, or until, I think in recent years, I think they've discovered a cure in the last few years. But generally speaking, leprosy has never had a cure, hence the existence of leper colonies and so on.
adult sores.
Yeah. Cauterizing the wounds,
yes.
If they've already lost fingers and so on, then yeah. I'm not so sure about that. Yeah, it has certain. Yeah, I'd have to check that because I'm not. There's different classes of things the way it treats there. It becomes a complex question. Yeah. But whether leprosy, well, what we call leprosy today, is very not very communicable. Like it's very hard to catch it. You sort of have to have. Usually they say you have to have kind of prolonged exposure. You know, you have to have prolonged close exposure for many years to get it. And it's certainly not readily curable like this. Like you can get a bit of herbal medicine and give it to him and then he's fine, you know. So probably what they're talking about is kutang is not really what we would call leprosy today. What it is exactly is not sure. And he's cured. And then... Sorry?
Can't it be that he doesn't have a
pedicure? Yeah. Yeah, but... I mean, I don't know. It doesn't sound reasonable to me. I mean, he seems like he's giving a realistic simile. You know, he's talking about.
Giving a realistic description of leprosy. I think. Maybe the difference is, but it seems very.
He's giving a realistic description of antecedents.
Yeah, of what we know as leprosy. That's why they translated it.
Oh, sure. It's similar. Yeah, but. Well, no, it's referring to an actual ancient disease, but obviously it has similar symptoms, which you might mistake for leprosy, but the curability of it seems to be different, that's all. Or the other thing, maybe they had a cure for leprosy and they lost it. It's quite possible. Okay, then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs of the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man envy that leper for his burning charcoal pit or his use of medicine? No, Master Gautama. Why is that? Because when there's sickness, there's need for medicine, and when there's no sickness, there's no need for medicine. Okay, so this is a fairly... in your face kind of metaphor. Yeah. So the same simile, then the leper, blah, blah, blah. Then his friends and companions brought a physician to treat him. The physician cured him. He became well and happy. And then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, I think he would, yes, because the fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think? Is it only now that the fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching, or previously too was the fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gautama, the fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too the fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. Of course, the fire wouldn't have been hot and painful if he'd had genuine leprosy, because his nerve endings would be gone. When the man was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. Okay.
The two strong men go right?
Yeah, it's kind of I think it's explained in various ways in the thing. Yeah, how is it explained in the commentaries? Can you remember that? The two strong men, uh-huh. Two strong men.
The
drag him. Yeah. What do they explain that? What do they? Like a criminal, yeah. Yeah, but it's explained, I think in the commentary explains it's like greed and craving or something like that. I can't remember what it is. I can't remember. Yeah, something like that. It's, sometimes it's used almost in the sense of, it's almost a bit similar to the idea of the wardens from hell who are dragging you into hell, or something like that. So it's like you're being forced against your will by the power of your past karma or something. You know, can't escape from your fate. Okay, so and here we have Albanto. Okay, so here's the interesting phrase that the Buddha used there. He's impaired faculties. Upahatindriyo, indriya is his sense faculties. Hata is destroyed. Upahata is probably a diminution of it. So impaired is probably quite a good rendering. And then his perception, distorted perception, sannyas is his perception. Viparita, perception. His perception like turned upside down or something like that. Can you translate it? Mistaken perception. Okay, so then it goes on. The similes get worse. Suppose there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. The more he scratches his scabs and cauterizes his body, the fouler, more evil-smelling, and more infected the openings of his wounds would become, and yet he would find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in scratching the openings of his wounds. So too, Magandhya, beings who are not free from sensual pleasures, blah, 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 they find a certain measure of satisfaction in them. Okay, so this is obviously a fairly in-your-face kind of... simile. Now then it goes to another kind of simile. What do you think, Magandhi? Have you ever seen or heard of a king or king's minister enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, was able to abide with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able or who will be able to so abide? So in the past, present and future, has anyone done that? Good Magandhya, I've never seen or heard of a king or king's minister enjoying himself who, without abandoning that craving, was able to abide free from thirst with mind inwardly at peace. Remembering, of course, that in the Indian literature, there are countless stories of kings who went forth, and many of these are told in the Buddha scriptures themselves about the fables of the past and ancient kings who renounced and went off into the forest and meditated and so on. And found inward peace. So they would have accepted that the kings were able to find peace, but only after renouncing first. On the contrary, Magandhya, those recluses and Brahmins who abide or will abide free from thirst with the mind inwardly at peace, all do so having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger and the escape in sensual pleasures, and it is after abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and removing fever for sensual pleasures that they abided or abide or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. So the Buddha is here making quite a definite declaration. One point here from the Chinese... Okay, the difference here in the sequence of the similes. The Chinese version presents a logical build-up of the argument. It begins by clarifying the predicament of the leper, then applies this to beings in general and to a king in particular, following by turning to the healed leper's attitude to the fire that he had formerly found so attractive. An attitude it presents in an ascending series by proceeding from his disinterest in using the fire for cauterization to his actual fear of being forcibly dragged into the fire. Okay, so the same similes found in the Chinese and the Pali, and the but a slightly different sequence. But I also noticed that this word here uses the idea that the king who abides with a mind inwardly at peace, and this is the word which the Buddha used earlier when he was describing himself with a mind inwardly at peace. So I kind of wonder whether that simile of the belongs perhaps a bit earlier. But anyway, same content.
But it occurs to me that the argument that when you find a text that has a more logical declension,
yeah.
Then that's indicative that it's earlier.
Yeah.
The argument could be turned the other way around as well. You could argue that the fact that it's not logical indicates that it's earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can. You can do it both ways. The rationale for arguing that is that first of all, that the Buddha made sense. So in this particular case, partly there's a general text critical argument. Okay, so this is part of a general text critical argument, which is that texts tend to be coherent. Because the native speaker who was speaking that knew what they were talking about. They knew the language that they were talking, and in a sense there's almost like a compassionate or a sympathetic assumption that almost like that, well, the reason why these people's words have been preserved is because they had something worth saying in the first place, and so that what they were saying was relatively coherent. And it's definitely the case that as text gets passed down, and especially as they become no longer the native text, the native language of the person who's actually reciting it, then they can be subject to corruption. So that's quite well documented. In this particular case, you'd also be reasonable to point to the fact that the Buddha, generally speaking, and very, very frequently, structured his discourses in a very rational manner. That was his style, yeah. And of course, there's probably a tendency. No doubt, there's been a tendency in the suttas to increase that, okay, to make it more systematic and so on. But it must have been working on something, you know. I mean, it wasn't just coming off the kind of the raving of a crazy wisdom master and then constructed the suttas like that. I mean, there must be something of the Buddha's flavour. So, I think it's very reasonable to presume that the Buddha actually was very careful and very logical in how he structured his discourses. So that doesn't negate what you say. It could well be that later standardization is going to increase that, and certainly that has happened in some cases. So what you try to do is you try to use these criteria. So in a case like this, where you have two different cases, one case from the Pali and the Chinese, which have a different presentation, then one seems more logical than the other. All you can do with that is really say, well, this one seems more logical than the other for that reason, and perhaps it might be earlier for that reason, or perhaps it might be later. So that's about all you can do. But to do text critical studies, it's more more solid foundation is you find as many independent criteria as you can, and when you find three or four independent things, like maybe a linguistic usage or maybe a connection with another doctrine in another place or something like that, you find three or four independent things pointing all in the same direction, then you can have a more solid foundation. Yeah.
The Pali version, I suppose, it's working on a whole lot of different logical levels anyway.
Right.
Just to sort of order it in, to take it like what appears to be the Chinese is ordered according to Anario, it's just taking one thread of that, like one type of thread, and ignoring some others.
Because it just kind of builds up to this idea of the sort of letting go of sensual pleasures to the positive revulsion from them. So it's more of a psychological build up. That particular one's a pretty tenuous kind of connection. But you know, all you can do is do that. Like if you're doing the comparative studies, you know, this is Analia's job in presenting this, is he presents the facts as they are and then offers an explanation. So it's just, you know, take it or leave it, really. I think that's reasonable. That again, the main point really is that in certain cases the Pali looks like it's maybe more authentic, in other cases maybe the Chinese does. Okay, so this is then the Buddha uttered his exclamation, "The greatest of all gains is health, Nibbana is the greatest bliss, the Eightfold Path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless." When this was said, the wanderer Magandhi said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Master Gautama, it is marvellous how well that has been expressed by the Master Gautama. The greatest of all gains is health, Nibbana is the greatest bliss." We too have heard earlier wanderers who were teachers and teachers of teachers saying this, and it agrees, Master Gautama. So, a couple of interesting things here. In the difference with the Chinese is that the Chinese notice that Magandhi only echoes the first two lines, okay? So the Chinese version only has the first two lines here. So again, this is another one of those things. Nalio thinks that makes more sense. The Buddha's uttered the first two lines. Magandhi repeats those first two lines, and then he adds the second two a bit later on. Okay, down here. So again, you can argue that makes more sense in terms of the dialogue. The verse itself, arogya parama labha, arogya is non-illness is the greatest gain. Nibbanam paramang sukham. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. Tangiko japmagganam, the Noble Eightfold Path. Kemang amatagamini gaminam goes to the deathless and the secure, the kema. So this is the verse, I believe, is found in the Dhammapada, or it is in the Dhammapada, same, yeah. And notice how the Buddha says, "Imang udanam udanesi." So he uttered this udana. Okay. Now the udana, as we have it today, is a book in the Pali canon called the Udana. But actually the Udana is also a type of literature or a type of teaching. And so here, as in quite a few cases, you find an Udana, which is not actually one of the Udanas as such, but it's the thing which is called an Udana, and here it's obviously like an inspired verse or something like that the Buddha would teach. And Analia has done a very interesting article on the Udana recently. If anyone wants to have a look at it, I can print that out. Basically the interesting thing about the Udana is that you can see that this particular verse doesn't have any hugely organic relationship with the teaching that's been going on, right? He could have taught that same verse in any number of contexts, yeah? He just happened to bring that out here. So, and then Magandhya says then this is something which he's already heard, sutang, he's already heard before in previous paribhadjikas. So in a sense the Buddha's ripping off an already existing teaching, okay? And in quite probably he's done that quite deliberately, yeah? He's psychologically, you know, he's obviously, Magandhi has been, you know, had quite an aggressive competitive attitude with him to start with. The Buddha's given him some pretty strong stuff, and now he's given him something to say, oh, okay, yeah, we have the same teaching, right? And so he's giving him a point of contact, which of course he'll then go on to revise the understanding of it, but at least he gives that point of contact. So here the Buddha clearly, so these udanas or verses, most of the udanas are verses, and they were kind of floating teachings which might be attached to various contexts. And Anala has shown that in the book, the Udana, that you have the actual Udana itself with a background story, but when you find that same Udana in the Chinese and other sources, that the background story is almost always completely different. And of course, this is exactly the same as we found with many of the Vinaya rules, that each tradition has the same Patimokkha rule, but the background story for it and the context that it's in is completely different in the different version.
When Magandhi is saying, we too have heard earlier wanderers or teachers and teachers saying this, is the this referring to the verse or to the whole of the previous discourse.
Just through the verse, yeah. Okay. So it is interesting. I mean, and this is quite important. For example, this idea, Nibbanang Paramang Sukhang. And that's quite a widely quoted Buddhist phrase. Yeah, Nibbana is the highest bliss. Yeah, it's quite a powerful and important phrase in Buddhism. But here it says it's taken from the Paribhajaka. Yeah.
It is a common belief in Indian culture.
Yeah.
But the Shramana movement.
Yeah. But how they understood Nibbana, of course, is different. Yeah. So then the Buddha says, well, what do they mean by Nibbana? So again, notice the Buddha's, you know, this is an interesting example for interfaith dialogue again. Yeah, as I said, like the Buddhist discourses actually are almost all, or very largely are actually all interfaith dialogues. But here he's given this thing where he has given something, well, here we have this teaching in common. He says, oh, okay, we have this thing in common. But then he's not therefore saying, well, therefore we're teaching exactly the same thing. He's taking an analytical approach. When your teachers said that, what is that help and what is that nirvana? When this was said, Wandramagandhiya rubbed his own limbs with his hands and said, this is that help, Master Gotama. This is that nirvana, for now I'm healthy and happy and nothing afflicts me. Which is fair enough. Yeah. Not too bad. Could be worse. Magandhi, suppose there was a man born blind who could not see dark and light forms, who could not see blue, yellow, red or pink forms. He could not see what was even or uneven, the stars or the moon or the sun. He might hear a man with good eyesight saying, good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless and clean. And he would go in search of a white cloth. And a man would cheat him with a dirty, soiled garment. Thus, good man, here is a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless and clean. And he would accept it and put it on, and being satisfied with it, he would utter words of satisfaction thus. Good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless and clean. What do you think, Magandhiya? When that man born blind accepted that dirty, soiled garment, put it on, and being satisfied with it, did he do so knowing and seeing, or out of faith in the man with good eyesight? Venerable sir, he would have done so unknowing and unseeing, out of faith in the man with good eyesight. Okay, so here, also very interesting, the notice that when Magandhiya made his initial claim about criticizing the Buddha, he relied purely on his sutta. Yeah? He said, oh, it's only because it contradicts what I've heard in the sutta, not because it's anything, something that he knew and see himself. Okay, and so here again we're talking about that the different epistemological criteria. Is it something you know and see? That is it an empirical reality? Is it an experiential reality? Or is it faith in the man with good eyesight?
Okay.
Well, exactly, yeah. Rather than trying to pretend, yeah. Venerable sir, hey, unknowing and unseeing. Okay, so too, Magandhiya, the wanderers of other sects are blind and visionless. They do not know health, they do not see Nibbana, and yet they utter this stanza thus. The greatest of all gains is health, Nibbana is the highest, greatest bliss. This stanza was uttered by the earlier accomplished ones, fully enlightened ones, thus. The greatest of all gains is health, Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The Eightfold Path is the best of paths, for it leads to safety, to the deathless. And now it has gradually become current among ordinary people. So again, this is quite an interesting claim, the idea that earlier Buddhas, and notice here it's definitely Samasam Buddhas, not Pacheka Buddhas, okay, who said that. And again, Pacheka Buddhas don't teach the Eightfold Path. So this kind of thing seems to be situating the previous Samasam Buddhas in an actual historical context. Of course, knowing what we know today about the history of India, then that's not possible that you know the timeline of the previous Sambuddha was countless millions of years ago, and there wasn't a society or culture in India that was spoken Pali for a start. So kind of interesting, but the other idea is that there was the general idea is that there was an authentic teaching in the past which has become degraded. They've actually lost bits of it. So they lost the second two lines, and they only misinterpreted the first two lines. And that's a very common theme in Indian literature. There's a wonderful passage in the Mulasarasivada Vinaya about that. I think it's in the Mulasarasivada Vinaya, where after the Buddha died, a few decades after the Buddha died, Ananda hears a monk reciting a verse, and he gets it all wrong, and it's got this kind of I can't remember what it is, but these kind of funny plays on words in the Sanskrit. So instead of saying, you know, live a life of diligence and perseverance and you will realize the deathless, instead it says something like the daggy crows sit in the swamp and croak all day, or something like that. And so another says, that's not how you're supposed to say it. You know, this is the right way of doing it. And then the young monk thinks, oh, this Ananda, he's just got so old and past it now, he just can't remember what his own verses were. So that was supposed to have happened even within a few decades, the Buddha passing away. Well, that's another one. Basically, according to Buddhism, the deathless is there's no death is conditioned by birth. So where there's no birth, then there's no aging and death. Certainly there's no physical birth, aging and death, yeah. But it's not doesn't mean the same as eternal life. Yeah, it just means there's no death. This the amata is a classic Brahmanical phrase. And so from the old usage, the Vedic usage, it basically meant eternal life, it meant what we call immortality. So that's one of these words which the Buddha adopted into his own system. I had a brief look at it, yeah. We should get some copies of that. Yeah, they haven't printed it. Yeah. Maybe print some out in thing. Arjun Pasano and Arjun Amaro have just come out with a book on Nibbana called The Island, which has got some nice quotes and things like that gathered together. I remember Arjun Pasano talking to me about that when I was in Wat Manachat in about 2001 or 2002. Which I can understand. Okay. Righty. Now, although this body, Magandhi, is a disease, a tumour, a dart, a calamity, and an affliction, referring to this body, you say, this is that health, Master Gautama, this is that Nibbana. You do not have that noble vision, Magandhya, by means of which you might know health and see Nibbana. So this particular passage and this sutta in general, of course, has a very negative attitude to the body. And this is something which is quite controversial in Buddhism, and it's often Buddhism has been commonly criticized for having a negative attitude towards the body, and based on passages like this. But it's also important to understand that the Buddha taught according to time and place, and that if you want to find positive passages about the body and referring to the body, there are plenty of them as well. For example, in the Kayagatasati Sutta and many other places where the Buddha emphasizes that the feeling of the rapture and the tranquility experienced in the body and all of these kinds of things. And so there's both kinds of teaching are found, and it depends on what context that you want to emphasize it. So there's certainly no doubt that what the Buddha is saying here is true, that the body is the source of a lot of affliction. And anyone who wants to say Nibbana, you know, the Nibbana or the highest bliss is found in the body, is bound to be disappointed. Okay. And you know, also you see that there is actually a successful teaching outcome in this sutta. So presumably the Buddha had some idea that Magandhya was capable of dealing with these kinds of teachings. So Magandhi says, I have confidence in Master Gautama thus. Master Gautama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can come to know health and to see Nibbana. So the Buddha then says, Magandhi, suppose there's a man born blind. The physician came, made a medicine for him, but by that medicine the man's vision would not arise or be purified. What do you think, Magandhi? Would that doctor reap weariness and disappointment? Yes, Master Gautama. So too, Magandhi, if I were to teach you to the Dhamma, you might not know health or see Nibbana, and that would be wearisome and troublesome for me. So what is it? Ah, yeah, that's just a hassle. Yeah, kind of interesting. Why should I teach you? You might wonder. He's obviously testing him, you know, quite seriously. He's given him the whole, you know, contradicted his ancient teachings and called his teachers blind and visionless and given him these really heavy similes. And now he says, why should I even bother teaching you? You probably wouldn't understand me anyway. Yeah. So poor Magandhi is getting a bit of a hard time here. No, it's there before the Buddha. Yeah. Well, exactly. This is the thing. It's probably meant a different thing in every different philosophy. Yeah. So, I mean, this particular ascetic understands it just as physical health. Yeah. So, no doubt there are other meanings in different philosophers. Yeah. Okay, so the Buddha then goes on. Suppose, with the simile of the white cloth, the man cheated him with the dirty, soiled garment, and then they brought the physician to treat the blind man, and the physician treated him, and his vision was cured. And then when he got his sight back, his desire and liking for that dirty, soiled garment would be abandoned. Then he might burn with indignation and enmity towards that man. I might think that he ought to be killed. Thus, indeed, I've long been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by this man with his dirty, soiled garment. When he's told me, good man, here's a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless, and clean. Bit of an overreaction, but then, you know, he's just got his eyesight cured. It must be a very traumatic situation for him. So, gotta cut him a bit of slack, I guess. So too, Magandhi, if I were to teach you the Dhamma, then you might know health and Nibbana, and together with the arising of your vision, your desire and lust for the five aggregates affected by grasping might be abandoned. Then perhaps you might think, indeed, I have a long time been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by this mind. For when grasping, I've been grasping just a material form, I've been grasping just feeling, I've been grasping just perception, I've been grasping just formations or activities. I've been grasping just a consciousness. With my grasping as condition, being comes to be. With being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. And of course, linking into dependent origination here, which perhaps comes back to who someone said earlier, that the thing about being conditioned by craving, independent origination, so that's maybe relevant there.
Interesting how you said that some ways said that the fraud is not the scripture, or his former teacher, but
yeah.
The fraud is actually the mind.
Fraud is his mind now, yeah. Okay, so let's just check with the Chinese here. There we
are. Does this mean that to understand Dhamma, you have to have all five senses in the problem?
No. No, he's just giving a simile.
Yeah.
Because
he hadn't had that before, so he did not.
Yeah, but no, that's just a simile.
Yeah.
Yeah. The man in the simile couldn't see. That's not the understanding of Dhamma. As long as you can understand the Dhamma, it doesn't matter if you have all your senses intact. Of course, it makes it much harder.
Yeah.
It makes it much harder, so you're saying it would be harder for a blind man to come to life than a man with full physical vision?
Yeah, of course. It was harder to do anything.
I guess it's because there's the the symbols to work from?
Well, no, it's just harder to educate yourself. It's harder to read things. Everything becomes more difficult. Yeah, exactly.
Is it in Braille?
I don't know. You can get a PDF file and have it read it to you. You have to listen to somebody in an electronic voice reading it to you. I mean, just everything becomes harder, yeah? So, yeah, nothing specifically about understanding. But I'm sure, you know, on the other hand, you've probably got good understanding of dukkha, so. Not sure. Don't know about that. I've never heard anything like that. Oh, yeah, yeah, I read that, yeah. Yeah. And who was he? Who was that one? He would also had his memory thing. He would memorize all the names and details for the underground.
Yeah. But also
he had various kinds of psychic vision. Yeah. Yeah, so it's a compensation thing. Yeah.
Oracles,
well, yeah. The blind, what is it, Tertiarius or something? The blind seers.
Okay.
Sorry? Okay, so the passage comparing the cheated man with understanding the five aggregates does not appear in the Chinese parallel. And instead, the Chinese version indicates that just as the healed blind man will be able to see his dirty garment for what it really is, so too Magandhi will be able to see Nibbana by acquiring the noble and purified eye of wisdom. Okay, so that's perhaps, again, you know, you might say that seems to be, the Chinese seems to be more logical. The introduction of the five khandhas there seems to be a bit not particularly organic in the context of the sutra as a whole. But anyway, okay, then it goes on to this next teaching. Okay. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I might rise up out of this seat, cured of my blindness. Right, so obviously you've got great faith in the Buddha. Then Magandhi, associate with true men. When you associate with true men, you'll hear the true Dhamma. When you hear the true Dhamma, you'll practice in accordance with Dhamma. When you practice in accordance with the true Dhamma, you will know and see for yourself. Thus, these are diseases, tumours and darts, but here these diseases, tumours and darts cease without remainder. With the cessation of my grasping comes cessation of being, with the cessation of being, cessation of birth, with the cessation of birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. When this was said, the wanderer Magandhi said, magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent, Master Gotama. And Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama, I would receive the full admission. So this, of course, is all stock passage. Okay, so here's the teaching, the Buddha's teaching to Magandhya that everything's building up to. You should first of all associate with the Sapurisa, which means the true man, the Aryans. And then if you associate with Sapurisa, then you get to hear the Sadhamma, the true Dhamma. Then when you hear the true Dhamma, then you get to Dhammanu Dhammang Papipadjisati. You will practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. Saddhamma is here. Saddhamma, yeah. You hear the Saddhamma. And then when you hear the Saddhamma, you will practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. Dhamma nu Dhammang. Ajahn Pasano translates that, making the little Dhammas fit into the big Dhammas, which I think is quite nice. And then when you do that, you will know for yourself, these are diseases, boils and darts. Here, these diseases, boils and darts, arapari sesa nirujhanti. End without remainder. And then it's the unbinding of dependent origination. Okay, so then he goes for the refuges, and this, of course, is the standard passage for taking refuge used by lay people. The passage that we use in the Pali, the passage that we use, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami and so on these days, was actually used for novice ordination. So, Esahang Bhavantang Gotamang Saranam Gacchami Dhammancha Bhikkhu Sanghancha. Okay, that's the going for the refuge. Labheyang Labheyahang Bhota Gotamasa Santike Pabajang Labheyang Upasampadang Te. So, go for. Take the going forth and the upasampada. Now, usually, if you hear that phrase by itself, often people assume that means I'll have novice ordination is the pabaja and upasampada is the bhikkhu ordination. Actually, in the early texts, pabaja and upasampada are usually just synonyms. So it just means I'm taking ordination. There's no need to distinguish the meaning. In certain cases, it might be, but most of the time, it just means the same thing.
So, was it novice ordination
in the current discipline? Originally there wasn't any novice ordination, and then later on novice ordination was introduced specifically for young boys. Yeah, so novice. Yeah, in the time of the Buddha, it seems novice ordination would have just been for people under 20, boys under 20 or girls under 20 to take. And then later on it became sort of conceived as a separate sort of stage in ordination. So you take novice ordination and then you take bhikkhu ordination. But actually the way bhikkhu ordination or bhikkhuni ordination is presented in the Pali canon doesn't presume that you're already a novice. So I give them both at the same time. So your first novice ordination. Okay. Then the Buddha says, those who are previously anyatitya pumba, who have gone forth in another religion, who wish to have going forth in this particular in this Dhamma Vinaya, they have to have be on probation for 4 months. And after 4 months of probation, if the bhikkhus are pleased with them, aradhajitta, the bhikkhus will give the going forth and full ordination into the state of being a bhikkhu. Apicha metta, but I know a differentiation or discrimination for individuals. Okay, so generally speaking, people would take the 4 months probation, but the Buddha is allowing that in certain individual cases that might be rescinded. Okay. And I think in the Vinaya, when it discusses this, it says two cases. One is if they are Sakyans, so it's family favouritism. And the other one is if they are... one particular kind of ascetic is the... I remember there's one particular kind of ascetic which is allowed... I think they're fire-worshipping... The Jatilas, I think. Fire-worshipping ascetics, he said they were Kamavada. Kamavadi know it.
Usually, yes, it's formally compensation for the other shell.
Usually, yeah.
But not in your body, he would just act like that, but he immediately
gives
the
power. Then he goes, yeah. 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 Don't know how often they applied it. But I think it's the Jatilas, the Brahman ascetics, who were teachers of karma, and the Buddha said because they're teachers of karma, then they don't have to do the probation. Then Magandhya says, well, if Bhante, if you say in this Dhamma Vinaya, you should wait for 4 years before, for 4 months before taking ordination, if I've belonged previously to another sect, then I'm happy to wait for 4 years, okay, and be on probation for 4 years before taking full ordination. All right, so that's, of course, again, a stock passage, but that's indicating the right attitude towards training. So not trying to resist the training or argue against it, saying he's not saying that's not fair. He's saying, well, if you think I should be on probation for 4 months, well, I'll do 4 years of probation if you want me to, because that's what I want to do, is to take the going forth. So this is a kind of when they show a good attitude, then he says, all right. He gives him the going forth straight away. Then Magandhi gained the going forth and gained the full ordination. And in no long time, apchi rupa santanno kopanayas magandiyo, eko, alone, vupakato, withdrawn, apamato, diligent, atapi, ardent, pahitato, resolute, dwelling, natira seva, in no long time, yasathaya kulaputta, so that goal for which, the syntax becomes a bit twisted here, but that goal for which sons of families, rightly, samadeva, go forth from the home life to homelessness, okay, from the home to homelessness, pabajanti, and notice here, of course, pabajanti just meaning ordained, doesn't mean novice ordination here, it just means ordained. So just again, that pabaja and upasampada are usually synonyms, as in this stop passage, it says upasampana at the beginning and then pabaja in the middle. Taranuttaram, that unexcelled brahmacharya pariyosanam, brahmacharya, the holy life, pariyosana, the outcome of the holy life, the consummation of the holy life, ditteva dhamme, in this very life. Okay, ditteva dhamme means in this very life. Sayam, for himself or of his own, abhinya, direct knowledge, higher knowledge, satchikapwa, having realized it, upasampadja vihasi, he enters and abides. So here's the same word as upasampada, but in a different meaning. Here it just means enters and abides in the knowledge of the truth. Kiyana jati vusitang brahmacharyan, birth is ended, holy life has been lived, has done what was to be done, and there's no more coming back to this birth or this kind of being. Abhanyasi, then he knew that. Okay, so this is it's a twisted one to try to translate. It's a long and convoluted syntax there. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, ardent, diligent, ardent and resolute, the Venerable Magandhya, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. All right. So it's a bit of a mouthful, but a very inspiring passage. Of course, when we look at the Chinese version, the teaching of the Buddha's instruction to Magandhi, it was very similar to frequent good friends, listen to the Dhamma and so on. And it's similar, there's a few slight differences in the wording in the Chinese, but basically similar. In the Chinese version, the Buddha indicated that practice in this way will lead to insight into the Four Noble Truths, which he then expounded in detail. This exposition caused Magandhya to attain stream entry, an outcome of the present discourse not reported in the Pali version. So here's quite a significant difference, that the Chinese has a long exposition of the Four Noble Truths, which is absent from the Pali. Now, of course, this is exactly the kind of thing which you would expect to be different from one version to the other, because the Buddha no doubt taught the Four Noble Truths countless times, and the redactors wouldn't include every time that it was there. So again, in this case, it's really whether you think he actually taught the Four Noble Truths there and the Chinese, you know, retained the original teaching, or whether you think that the Pali is more likely because it's short, or whether the Pali's been abbreviated. It could have been either. But the fact also that he became a stream enterer, not mentioned in the Pali. The Pali and the Chinese version agree on Magandhya requesting ordination. While according to the Chinese version, the Buddha readily granted this, which would make sense if he was already a stream enterer, in the Pali version he indicated that followers of a different tradition had to undergo the probation period. According to both versions, once ordained, Magandhya in due time became an arahant. So in the Chinese version, the Buddha actually gives the ehi bhikkhu ordination. Okay. So this is an example of the ehi bhikkhu ordination occurring in the Madhyama Agama. In the passage, it's not found in the Pali. Now, this particular detail is actually extremely common, that the reports on the outcome of the teaching differ almost all the time, okay, in the different versions, okay. And this is very, very typical And we'll encounter this again and again and again as we go through the comparative study, that we've looked at all the teachings there, and we look at the teachings, the body of the text, which the Buddha actually said himself, that there's hardly any difference, a few vague differences in wording and sequence of things and so on, but no substantial doctrinal difference whatsoever in the actual teaching which the Buddha is giving. Okay, but the outcome, which notice the outcome is not the Buddha's words, okay? The outcome is what was added by the redactor. It's the appendix to the actual sutta itself. And that outcome is depicted in quite different terms. According to the Chinese version, he gets a long discourse on the Four Noble Truths, and then he becomes a stream enterer, requests ordination, gets the Ehi Bhikkhu ordination, and then becomes an ordination. In the Pali, he requests ordination, is initially denied it, or with the reservation of having the probation, which then seems to be rescinded, and then he ordains. So, and there's no question of him becoming a stream enterer actually in the discourse itself. Although one might think that that's implied in the Pali, because Magandhya says, I have confidence that the Buddha will teach me the Dhamma so that I will see it in this very seat before rising from this seat. So perhaps a suggestion in the Pali that might have been the case as well. But in any case, just so as long as you're clear with that, this is this difference between the actual body of the text, which is taught by the Buddha, and the details supplied by the redactors. And the body of the text tends to be very similar, the details supplied by the redactors tend to be quite different. Okay, any other questions? I don't think so, no. It's not a very common name. Ganda, I mean, the word Ganda is spelt with the retroflex in the Burmese recension. And like this, Ganda. And that's actually one of the diseases, boils, isn't it? Ganda. Yeah? Ma Ganda, don't have boils. According to the commentary, it's his nephew. That's right, yeah, it's a story in the Sutta Nipata. Yeah, when they come along and try to give their daughter to the Buddha in the Sutta Nipata, yeah? Yeah, that story, according to the commentary, that's the that Magandhya was the nephew of the wanderer Magandhya. Yeah, yeah. It says in the Dictionary of Pali proper names, it has the details there.
But I think this indicates that Madhavi Sutra was the original version of the Monty Python begging for alms for an ex leper.
Begging for alms for an ex leper.
I'm
not familiar with that
one.
In the life of Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, any other questions before we finish? Parato ghosa.
Ghosa?
No, just ghosa. Parato ghosa, yeah. It means the voice of another.
Voice of another.
The voice of another, yeah.